content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And this week, of course, we'll be reading from the issue dated March 25th, 2011. And before we begin reading from the print version of the magazine here, I'd like to bring you up to date with a couple of new items online from the week relating to the circumstances in Libya. The first one is entitled, Assault on Libya, Whose Side Are the Arabs On? The Arab League urged the West, including France's Nicolas Sarkozy, to intervene in Libya. Now they may be having second thoughts. The Arab League's call for a no-fly zone over Libya was one of the key catalysts in convincing the UN to authorize Western military intervention. But since the U.S., Britain, and France started bombing Libyan targets to enforce the no-fly zone, the reaction from the Arab world has become more nuanced. Arab League chief Amar Moussa criticized the bombing, then backed off a bit. The United Arab Emirates rejected expectations that it will lend military aid to the effort, and Syria is outright hostile to the airstrikes. So whose side are the Arabs on in this war? With allies like these, who needs enemies? Sadly, it is utterly predictable that Arab leaders are having second thoughts now that the bombs are dropping, says Jeffrey Goldberg at The Atlantic. Anyone who expected them to stand with the West when it was uncomfortable to stand with the West is delusional. And that's especially true of the cowardly Arab League and Amar Moussa, nobody's idea of a good ally. Wait, most Arabs are united against Gaddafi. Arab leaders were rightly lauded for their resolve and unity when they called for the no-fly zone, says Abu Dhabi's The National in an editorial. And crucially, that unity is holding. Gaddafi is trying his best to pit Mideast against West, but he's badly misjudged the mood on the Arab street. In fact, rarely has an attack in the region by an international coalition received such backing from Arab regimes and, just as importantly, from their people. It's complicated. Moussa's flip-flopping is pretty representative of Arab opinion, says Mark Lynch in Foreign Policy. Bombing Libya has triggered anger among a significant portion of the Arab public, understandably suspicious of Western intervention. But the newly empowered Arab street also sees Libya as a litmus test for the future of the Arab revolution, and not acting would have damned Obama in their eyes. The next related item is entitled, Libya Airstrikes, Should Gaddafi Be a Target? Military officials insist the U.S. and its allies are not trying to kill Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, but commentators wonder if that rhetoric matches the reality. President Obama says that Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi must go, and British government ministers suggest he would be a legitimate target. But while Western airstrikes have blasted Gaddafi's compound in Tripoli, Defense Secretary Robert Gates says no cruise missiles or bombs are being aimed directly at him, and British military commanders say that going after Gaddafi specifically is prohibited under the United Nations Security Council resolution, which authorizes the use of force to protect Libyan civilians. If we're not aiming at Gaddafi, should we be? It would be illegal to assassinate Gaddafi. Allied warships and planes are not shooting directly at Gaddafi, says Libya expert Charles Gurdon, as quoted by AOL News, because we can't. Legally, no Western leader can sanction the assassination of another leader. Allied forces wouldn't be upset if a bomb happened to land on Gaddafi, but they have to content themselves with blowing up his artillery and aircraft to make it impossible for the regime to wage war on the people. Where is Gaddafi hiding this time as missiles strike Libya? Well, if we're not targeting Gaddafi, we should be. This is war, says Ed Morrissey at Hot Air. And the reason we're fighting is to protect Libyans from Gaddafi. That makes him the most legitimate target of all. Because taking out the guy who is commanding loyalist forces will go much farther toward ending the siege of Benghazi than strafing infantry and armor in and around the city. Of course we're aiming at Gaddafi. We just can't admit it. With missiles landing on the Libyan dictator's house, the claim that we are not targeting Gaddafi himself rings false, says Jason Ditz at antiwar.com. The Obama administration has to say it's not trying to kill Gaddafi to reassure the Arab League, vital allies in this fight, that we're not going beyond the UN mandate. The reality is just getting obscured by the rhetoric. Now let's turn to the print publication of the Week magazine for this Friday, March 25th. The lead story here, the main story this week, is A Battered Japan Faces Nuclear Disaster. What happened? Japan struggled this week to cope with its largest disaster since the nuclear devastation of Hiroshima and Nagasaki after a magnitude 9.0 earthquake off the country's northeast coast triggered a tsunami that rolled 6 miles inland, devastating towns, obliterating villages, and causing partial meltdowns at three nuclear reactors. Prime Minister Naoto Kan pleaded for calm as fires and explosions from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power station, about 150 miles north of Tokyo, blew holes in containment vessels in two of the plant's six reactors after the quake and tsunami had knocked out their cooling systems. A skeleton crew of 50 technicians risked their lives as they struggled to keep exposed white-hot nuclear fuel rods covered in seawater in a desperate attempt to head off multiple complete meltdowns and a large release of radioactivity. "We are on the brink," said Hiroki Koide, a nuclear specialist at Kyoto University. The Japanese government evacuated people living within 12 miles of the plant and urged those within 18 miles, about 140,000 people, to stay indoors and to make their homes airtight. The apocalyptic cascade of catastrophes began last Friday when the quake, the largest to hit Japan in recorded history, launched a wall of churning water that rolled relentlessly inland, ripping homes from their foundations and tossing cars and boats as though they were toys. More than 10,000 people are believed to have been killed. Tens of thousands more are injured, and up to 500,000 people have been made homeless. "Everything is lost," said 48-year-old construction worker Takeo Oyama, whose village, Saito, was completely flattened. On the coast, thousands of bodies washed up after having been sucked out to sea. In Tokyo, an eerie silence fell over usually busy streets and restaurants as residents alarmed by the nuclear crisis 150 miles away stayed indoors. Here's what the editorials had to say. "Strange as it may sound, it could have been far worse," said the Washington Post. "If the quake had struck closer to Tokyo or other large urban areas farther south, or if Japan's building codes had not been the best in the world, the death toll could have been much higher. In Tokyo, the skyscrapers swayed but remained standing. Shopkeepers dashed to emergency shelters, but there was no looting. It was a reminder of just how much of the damage of a natural disaster is avoidable in a well-ordered society. Still, the size of this earthquake overpowered even Japan's elaborate defenses against natural disasters," said the New York Times. "The quake knocked out power to the cooling systems at Fukushima Daiichi, and the seawalls proved no match for the tsunami that flooded the plant's backup diesel generators. The country now faces what Prime Minister Kan described as its most difficult challenge since World War II," said the Christian Science Monitor. "Compounding the catastrophe are a pre-quake national mood of gloom and defeatism fueled by Japan's polarized political system, which has produced five prime ministers in 5 years, and an economy mired in two decades of stagnation. If there is a silver lining to this disaster, it's that Japan now has a chance to tap the unity of its people and reform its society from the ground up." What the columnist said. "Pundits said only a major crisis will bring about change in Japan," said William Pesek in the New York Post. Well, here it is. Days before the quake, Japan's foreign minister was forced to resign over a clerical error, and the opposition was digging up petty dirt on the prime minister, too. Such distractions are no longer an option. This is the Japanese leadership's golden opportunity to roll up their sleeves, reverse wage stagnation, and rein in the world's largest public debt as the country embarks on a massive rebuilding program. All that would require leadership, and thus far, there's little on display, said Lennox Samuels in the DailyBeast.com. The government seems to be fumbling this crisis, giving out inadequate or confusing advice at best, and exacerbating the national mood of foreboding and alarm. The administration seems overwhelmed by a disaster that has forced 11 of the country's 55 nuclear plants to shut down and resulted in rolling blackouts across the country. What administration wouldn't be, said Robert Madsen in Foreign Policy. As with the 2008-2009 financial crisis, mankind is frequently wrong-footed by black swans, events that seem so beyond the realm of possibility that we fail to prepare for them. This disaster is a failure not of human engineering, but of human imagination. Modern engineers and scientists thought that by quake-proofing buildings and putting backup generators and thick containment vessels at nuclear plants, humankind had triumphed over risk, said Harold Meyerson in the Washington Post. Sadly, as the people sealed inside their homes near Japan's broken nuclear plants could tell us, the experts were wrong. Which is all the more reason why we in California need to take heed, said Donald Prothero in the Los Angeles Times. Several of the faults in our region are overdue for major quakes. Although our building codes are among the most stringent in America, they don't begin to compare to Japan's. Our two nuclear power plants are designed to withstand 7.0 and 7.5 magnitude earthquakes. But the San Andreas Fault is capable of exerting much more force. Those who ignore these warnings now will regret it when the next big one hits. And in a related article, the controversy of the week is entitled Japan, Is This the End for Nuclear Power? So much for the nuclear renaissance, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Until last week's earthquake-triggered disaster at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear complex, even some prominent environmentalists had begun championing nuclear power, portraying it as a means to end our dependence on foreign oil and significantly mitigate global warming all at the same time. President Obama has promoted the addition of nuclear plants in his new energy policy, and the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission was poised to approve the construction of 20 new reactors. But with crisis turning to catastrophe in Japan, those plans will now almost certainly go on hold, though so these plants' ability to withstand earthquakes can be reviewed. There will probably be questions raised about all of the 104 operating nuclear plants around the United States, many of them close to population centers and or seismic fault lines. Even if the risk of catastrophe is tiny, the worst-case scenario is so dreadful as to be unthinkable. Rather than the answers to all our prayers, nuclear power is suddenly looking more like a bargain with the devil. The Japanese are keeping admirably cool amid the chaos, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. We wish we could say the same for the reaction in the U.S. The fact is that every energy source has risks. Oil rigs sometimes blow up and cause giant spills. Coal mines sometimes collapse, killing miners. Adding more solar and wind power, meanwhile, would require claiming vast tracts of land and seascape for giant windmills and vast arrays of solar panels, and overcoming the fierce resistance of the not-in-my-backyard crowd. To see the scope of the problem, consider the Cape Wind Project, said Alex Berezau in RealClearScience.com. When a company proposed building a windmill farm, off the Massachusetts coast, the wealthy environmentalists who own homes on Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard, including the Kennedy family, raised a giant stink. Environmentalists should not be given a seat at the adults' table until they demonstrate an ability to propose a serious solution to the most serious of problems. Fine, let's get serious, said Ann Applebaum in the Washington Post. Advocates of nuclear energy insist that the next generation of nuke plants will be safer still. But if the competent and technologically brilliant Japanese can't build a completely safe reactor, who can? The Fukushima plant may have been built 40 years ago, but its safety systems were constantly reviewed and re-engineered to proof it against any conceivable natural disaster. The engineers were wrong, weren't they? Indeed they were, said James Acton in Foreign Policy, making this a pivotal moment for the nuclear industry. It must resist the temptation to argue that the accident in Japan was simply an extraordinarily improbable confluence of events, and that everything is just fine. The only way for the industry to restore public trust is to reassess the basic design of all nuclear reactors and to determine whether they are truly capable of withstanding the whole range of natural and man-made disasters that might befall them. But let's also realistically weigh the risks of every alternative, said the Chicago Tribune. Air pollution from burning fossil fuels, scientists say, kills 2 million people a year, far more than all the nuclear incidents worldwide, including Chernobyl. The possibility of a nuclear accident will always be with us, and it will always be scary, but not as scary as a world starved for electricity. And now let's turn to the very popular feature in the Week magazine called Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. Always entertaining. It was a good week for Mexican fishermen who had their best day in years after scooping up buckets full of sardines, striped bass, and mackerel that suddenly appeared in dense schools off the country's west coast. The fishermen theorized that the fish had been stampeded in their direction by Japan's undersea earthquake. It was a good week for actual human contact after Christian clergy said a large number of people have given up Facebook for Lent. Facebook is almost compulsive, said Lutheran pastor Dan Hughes, and that's why it makes sense to give it up for Lent. And it was a good week for payback after a California man elected to pay a $6,500 credit card bill by delivering a load of 650,000 pennies to the bank. It was a bad week for waking up late after 500 chronically late or absent students at Durfee High School in Conway, Massachusetts, started getting robocalls featuring the booming voice of the school principal saying, "It's 6:15 and it's Durfee High School calling." It was a bad week for high expectations after 9,700 Ohio taxpayers received letters promising huge tax refunds, some up to $200 million. The Ohio Department of Taxation blamed the letters on a software glitch. And it was a bad week for sophisticated humor after hackers changed an electric highway sign in Houston, which originally said detour, to spell out poop. After 2 days, the sign then changed to LOL, which I think, in my non-Facebook way of looking at things, means lots of laughs. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine right here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Now we'll turn to the People section of the Week magazine. Our first article here is entitled, Why Ruffalo Doesn't Trust Success. Most actors have a few ups and downs, but Mark Ruffalo has truly been on a roller coaster ride, says John Preston in the London Telegraph. In 2000, Ruffalo had been struggling in Hollywood for a decade when he appeared in the Oscar-nominated film You Can Count on Me. It was his big break, but one night he dreamed he had a brain tumor. The dream turned out to be true, and though the tumor was non-malignant, the operation to remove it left one side of his face paralyzed. In all, I disappeared for a year, he says. There were all kinds of rumors about what had happened to me. Drugs, alcoholism, AIDS. Whatever the truth, I was damaged goods. I mean, no one is going to hire an actor with a paralyzed face. Ruffalo slowly recovered and rebuilt his career until 2008, when his brother was murdered. Maddened by grief, he fired his agent and left Los Angeles. Then he was offered a part in The Kids Are All Right. Now, with an Oscar nomination under his belt, his career is back on track, but he doesn't take success seriously. If I walk around the house saying, "Hey, I'm no longer a B actor," do you think that means anything to my kids? Of course not. They just give me this funny look and go, "Yeah, yeah, we want our breakfast." The next item is entitled "The Girl Who's Smarter Than Einstein." Victoria Cowie will almost always be the smartest person in the room, said Claire Ellicott in the London Daily Mail. The 11-year-old from Shropshire, England, was extraordinarily bright from an early age, reading elementary school books as a toddler. But her teachers, parents, and Victoria, too, were shocked when she scored 162 on an IQ test. That surpasses the 160 thought to belong to Albert Einstein, Bill Gates, and Stephen Hawking. "When I got the results, I was really surprised," Cowie says. "It's quite daunting to be compared to great minds, but it feels good also to be thought of as clever." Cowie hardly seems like anything other than a normal 11-year-old, other than the fact that she seems to be avidly interested in everything. "I really enjoy science and doing experiments, but I also love acting and dancing and playing musical instruments. I do theater workshops and loads of sports like swimming." She's fairly certain what she wants to do with her gifts. "My favorite subject is biology, and I want to be a vet when I'm older because I love animals and I'm not afraid of blood." Right now, though, she's got a less ambitious goal. Her parents, she says, have told her to clean up her room. And now from the Week magazine, let's turn to the special weekly feature that is part of the briefing section. And the title for this week's section is "Where America's Jobs Went." In a globalized economy, American corporations are rapidly shifting their workforces abroad. Why aren't U.S. corporations hiring? Actually, many of them are. They're just not hiring Americans. In the 2 years after the Wall Street meltdown triggered the Great Recession, large American corporations slashed U.S. payrolls by a net of 500,000 jobs. At the same time, though, they hired 729,000 workers overseas. As globalization transforms the world economy, in fact, many U.S.-based companies are shifting the balance of their workforces overseas. Ford, for example, reported in 1992 that 53% of its employees worked in the U.S. and Canada. By 2009, its North American workforce, by then Ford had expanded to Mexico, made up only 37% of total payroll. With 53% of big U.S. firms implementing offshore strategies, there is no job security now, said Lauren Asplund of the IUECWA, an electrical workers union. When did offshoring become so prevalent? Well, the trend began in earnest in the late 1970s at large manufacturers such as General Electric. GE's then CEO, Jack Welch, who was widely respected by other corporate chieftains, argued that public corporations owe their primary allegiance to stockholders, not employees. Therefore, Welch said, companies should seek to lower costs and maximize profits by moving operations wherever is cheapest. Ideally, Welch said, you'd have every plant you own on a barge to move with currencies and changes in the economy. Not only did GE offshore much of its manufacturing, so did its parts suppliers, which were instructed at GE-orchestrated supplier migration seminars to migrate or be out of business. Is offshoring limited to manufacturing? It used to be, until the internet boom of the 1990s made it a white-collar phenomenon, too. As economic globalization gathers speed and technology erases geographic boundaries, firms now have instant access to educated workers all over the planet, allowing enormous service companies and small businesses alike to hire web designers in Thailand, graphics specialists in India, and seismologists in Pakistan. White-collar workers who once seemed immune to offshoring, lawyers, financial analysts, even local newspaper reporters, are now in peril of seeing their jobs shifted to India, Eastern Europe, or China. In recent years, 13 of every 100 U.S. computer programming jobs shifted overseas, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, making it the most at-risk occupation in America. Any job you can think of now can be done by someone on the other side of the world for less cost, said Matt Berry, CEO of Freelance.com, which matches employers and freelancers around the world. Are labor costs the driving factor? Yes, but they're only one reason companies prefer to hire foreign workers. By offshoring, firms can also sidestep more stringent U.S. workplace and environmental regulations, and they can take advantage of foreign government subsidies designed to lure foreign investment. They can also tap a labor pool that in many cases is better versed in math and science than the U.S. workforce is. Thus, offshoring has evolved from a simple matter of cutting labor cost to a multidimensional value proposition, as the conference board's Tom Hegeman puts it. Part of the value is that foreign workers can be required to work under conditions that would be illegal in the U.S. In Shenzhen, China, for example, Foxconn, the subsidiary of a Taiwanese company, employs 250,000 people to assemble iPods and iPhones for Apple, working long, monotonous days with a handful of timed bathroom breaks. Foxconn workers earn an average wage of $292 a month. Last year, 18 Foxconn employees at the Shenzhen complex attempted suicide, 14 successfully. Is the offshoring strategy working? For employers, absolutely. In the third quarter of 2010, U.S. corporate profits hit an all-time high of $1.659 trillion, despite a U.S. unemployment rate hovering above 9%. By no coincidence, in 2009, nearly half, 47% of the revenues of the 500 largest U.S. public companies came from outside the U.S. And economic growth rates are much stronger overseas. From 1995 through 2008, the U.S. gross domestic product grew at an annual average of 2.9%, a crawl compared with average annual growth of 9.6% in China and 6.9% in India. Businesses go where the growth is. For a lot of American companies, their actual and psychic energy is focused abroad, said Matthew Slaughter of Dartmouth University's Tuck School of Business. Is more offshoring inevitable? Yes, unless the federal government decides to discourage it. Currently, the U.S. levies no tax on U.S. firms' overseas earnings as long as those profits remain overseas. And that policy essentially encourages companies to reinvest their profits outside the U.S. And to give companies even more incentive to hire overseas, the Internal Revenue Service allows companies that move factories abroad to deduct from their taxable income the costs of closing their U.S. plants. Democrats in the Senate attempted last autumn to close those loopholes and create incentives to repatriate profits and jobs, but pro-business Republicans blocked their proposal. The whole concept of offshoring, said Mark Toon of offshoring advisory firm Equiterra, is here to stay. And the related cutout article in this particular briefing, training your own replacement. I'd like my new team to meet my old team, Mara Breinstein's boss said, by way of opening the meeting at Watchmark, a Bellevue, Washington developer of software for cell phone companies. Breinstein and 17 other U.S.-based software testers were meeting the 20 engineers fresh off the plane from India who had been hired to replace them. Bronstein and her colleagues were expected to spend the final 2 months of their WatchMark careers training them. If they refused, WatchMark would withhold their severance payments. "It totally knocked the wind out of me," Bronstein said. "It was the most difficult situation in the world." WatchMark managers said they had little choice but to export the jobs. Salaries for U.S.-based software engineers start at $75,000 a year. India-based engineers start at $15,000. Bronstein was left feeling like a sucker. "I never would have gone into the technology field in the first place if I had a crystal ball and knew the bottom was going to drop out. Now they want much more from you for much less." A lot of Americans know exactly how she feels. You're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for Friday, March 25th, 2011. Now let's take a look at the best columns in the U.S. this past week, according to the Week magazine. The first one is entitled "The Solution to Educational Mediocrity," written by Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. "We need to pay teachers more," said Nicholas Kristof. That may sound like heresy at a time when public sentiment has turned against teachers' unions. But if we are serious about improving the nation's schools, the first step is to end union rules that guarantee bad teachers a job, and the second is to pay teachers a salary that will attract top-notch people to the profession. Starting teachers pay averages $39,000 a year, lower than most other white-collar professions, which is one big reason why 47% of our teachers are now culled from the bottom one-third of their college classes. No wonder schools are struggling. Studies have found that the most effective teachers can, over 4 years, eliminate the black-white achievement gap in inner-city schools and add to the earning power of even good students. In nations whose educational performance we now envy, such as Singapore and South Korea, teachers are highly respected and earn more than lawyers and engineers. In the U.S., starting salary should rise to $65,000. The best teachers should earn $100,000 or more. It's the only way we're going to attract the kind of above-average teachers our above-average children deserve. The next column from the Week magazine is entitled "Smile, You're Being Recorded" by Gordon Kravitz in the Wall Street Journal. "For better or worse, we've entered an age of radical transparency," said Gordon Kravitz. "Technology has shoved aside long-standing expectations of privacy, turning every conversation and personal action into a chance to expose unintended truth. Consider the recent sting in which conservative prankster James O'Keefe videoed National Public Radio's top fundraiser making what he thought were private attacks on the Tea Party, and how a liberal blogger posing as a conservative billionaire baited Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker into saying some nasty things about his pro-union Democratic opponents. No one, however, has been caught out as spectacularly as Steve Donziger, a lawyer who won a $9 billion judgment in Ecuador against Chevron for allegedly damaging the rainforest. Last week, a U.S. judge blocked that payment on the basis of outtakes from a documentary in which Donziger said that Ecuadorian judges were all corrupt and would respond to intimidation and humiliation. Clearly, privacy is on the wane, but it may be worth that loss to gain a clearer understanding of what people really believe." And the next column from the Week's Best is entitled "How to Increase the Deficit" by Ezra Klein in the Washington Post. "Is it possible to cut government spending and actually raise the deficit?" asked Ezra Klein. "Republicans have proposed doing just that by making dramatic cuts in federal spending for enforcement efforts by the IRS, food inspectors, and fraud investigators for Medicaid and Medicare. In their budget battle with Senate Democrats, House Republicans are attempting to wield a machete on a host of regulatory programs on purely ideological grounds. They have voted to cut $600 million from the budget of the IRS, even though it's been shown that every dollar the agency spends on chasing down tax cheats brings in $10 to the Treasury. so that $600 million cut would add billions to the deficit. Cutting food inspection will inevitably result in more outbreaks of foodborne illness, increasing our health care costs. Ditto for eliminating investigators who chase down fraud in Medicare and Medicaid billings. Why would the GOP favor cuts that very obviously hurt taxpayers? Because deficit reduction is not the GOP's top priority, as it proved when it demanded an extension of the Bush tax cuts and added $4 trillion to the deficit. The GOP's agenda is to cut spending, results be damned. And now from The Week magazine, let's take a look at the article that's entitled The Last Word, always an interesting feature from The Week. This one for this week is entitled, It's Strange That I Am Alive. As the Japanese tsunami rushed inland, people fled in panic, clung to railings, or were swallowed by the sea. The Japanese have always lived on the brink. For centuries, their islands have trembled. Great waves scoured the shores. Their homes were made of wood. Their finest art appeared as flimsy prints. Their most famous poetry was short and fleeting. A sense of impermanence was part of life. Yet, last Friday afternoon at 2:46 p.m., the greatest earthquake since records began in Japan 140 years ago came as a terrible, unexpected shock. In Tokyo, the skyscrapers started shaking like trees. Oil tanks ruptured. Refineries burst into flames. The 186-mile-per-hour bullet trains ground to a halt. Mobile phone networks fell silent. A pall of smoke hung over the capital, home to 13 million people. Thousands of commuters gasped as underground trains swayed in creaking, groaning tunnels. The airports closed. In nuclear plants, which provide a third of the energy in oil-starved Japan, technicians raced to shut down reactors. But at the 40-year-old Fukushima reactors, an explosion blew the tops off two buildings as engineers fought to stop a meltdown. More than 200,000 people were evacuated. The ghosts of Chernobyl and Three Mile Island hung in the air. When news spread of a radiation leak at the nuclear power plant, which is run by the Tokyo Electric Power Company, there was panic on social networking sites. Came back home at 8 in the morning after the depressing night. Now the nuclear power plant has exploded, and we might already be exposed to radioactivity, said a 23-year-old female office worker from Tokyo on a Facebook page. I just don't know what to do, what's coming next, and will I be alive tomorrow? The nuclear alarm capped a double disaster. The quake of 9.0 magnitude was followed by a tsunami, a word Japan gave to the world, which tore into the isolated northeast coast of the main island on Honshu and was so powerful that it rippled around the Pacific Ocean to California and Chile. I heard a strange sound, the kind of sound I have never heard before, said Kazushi Ara, a 51-year-old office worker in the city of Soma, near the stricken nuclear plant. I looked back. Waves cascaded over the trees that make up our beach windbreak and rushed toward me. I ran like crazy. When the waters receded, whole cities were ablaze and in ruins. Trains had vanished. Ships and boats lay tossed like bath-time toys along a ravaged coastline. The water swept inland about 6 miles in some areas, swallowing boats, homes, cars, trees, and everything else. In stricken Sendai, smashed cars and small aircraft were jumbled up against buildings near the airport several miles from the shore. Felled trees and wooden debris lay everywhere as rescue workers and boats moved through murky waters around flooded structures. A 29-year-old man told how he survived the wall of water that hit Sendai. I hurried into my car, he recalled. Then came the tsunami. But fortunately, my car floated on the waves. I saw three men working at a petroleum pumping station being swept away. It's strange that I'm alive. Koichi Takeran, a 34-year-old driver who was inside his 4-ton truck when the wave hit, said, The tsunami was unbelievably fast. Smaller cars were being swept around me. All I could do was sit in my truck. He joined the flow of survivors who walked along the road away from the sea and back into the city. One of them, Kumi Onodera, a 34-year-old dental technician, said that the night after the tsunami was like a scene from a disaster movie, punctuated by frequent aftershocks. The road was moving up and down like a wave. Things were on fire, and it was snowing, she said. You really come to appreciate what you have in your everyday life. Hirosato Weiko stared at the ruins of his small fishing hamlet in the city of Natori. Skeletons of shattered buildings, twisted lengths of corrugated steel, corpses with their hands twisted into claws. Only once before had he seen anything like it, World War II. I lived through the Sendai air raid, said Mr. Weiko, 75 years old, referring to the Allied bombings of the Northeast's largest city. But this is much worse. For the elderly who live in the villages lining Japan's northeastern coast, it is a return to a past of privation that their children have never known. As in so much of the Japanese countryside, young people have largely fled, looking for work in the city. The elderly who remained are facing devastation and possible radiation contamination, a challenge equal only to the one this generation faced when the defeated, despairing nation had to rebuild from the rubble of the war. Several days after the tsunami struck, the search for survivors was turning into a search for bodies, and most of those bodies were old, too old to have outrun the tsunami. Yuta Saga, 21, was picking up broken cups after the earthquake when he heard sirens and screams of tsunami. He grabbed his mother by the arm and ran to the junior high school, the tallest building around. Traffic snarled the streets as panicked drivers crashed into one another. He could measure the waves advance by the clouds of dust created by collapsing buildings. When they reached the school, Mr. Saga and his mother found the stairs to the roof clogged with older people who appeared unable to muster the strength to climb them. Some were just sitting or lying on the steps. As the bottom floor filled with fleeing residents, the wave hit. At first the doors held, then water began to pour through the seams and flow into the room. In a panic to reach the roof, younger residents began pushing and yelling, "Hurry!" and "Out of the way!" They climbed over those who were not moving or elbowed them aside. "I couldn't believe it," Mr. Saka said. "They were even shoving old people out of the way. The old people couldn't save themselves," he added. "People didn't care about others." Then the doors burst open and the water rushed in. It was quickly waist level. Mr. Saga saw one older woman without the strength or will to stand, sitting in water that rose to her nose. He said he rushed behind her, grabbed her under the arms, and hoisted her up the stairs. Another person on the stairs grabbed her and lifted her up to another person. The men formed a human chain, lifting the older residents and some children to the top. "I saw the ugly side of people, and then I saw the good side," Mr. Saga said. "Some people only thought of themselves. Others stopped to help." Mr. Saga said one woman handed him her infant. "Please at least save the baby," she pleaded as water rose above his chest. Mr. Saga said he grabbed the baby and ran up the stairs. Many of those still at the foot of the stairs were washed away. He joined about 200 people on the second floor of the building. The baby's mother rushed upstairs, and he put the baby into her arms. From the windows, they watched uprooted homes and cars flowing by on the wave. "People did not speak," he said. "They just cried and moaned, a collective ah, as they watched the destruction unfold." He saw one of his classmates whose parents had gone back home to get something as the wave came and did not make it to the school. His friend sat on the floor in tears. Mr. Saga's family was safe, including his 15-year-old brother, Ryota, who'd fled to the school by bicycle. On Monday, the two brothers returned to the hamlet for the first time. The house was entirely gone, just the foundation was left. When they got there, a false tsunami alert sounded. They ran for higher ground, then the younger boy broke down, sobbing. "He cannot forget the memory of what happened," Mr. Saga said. "Many of my friends are missing," Ryota said. Hisako Tano, 50, was working at a warehouse when the earthquake struck. He rushed home to get her 77-year-old father as she parked in front of her home, and she heard screams. She looked down the street to see a mountain of garbage moving down the street at her. It was the wave. "I only had time to grab my bag and run," Ms. Tano said. Her neighbors called to her from their home, and she ran up to their second floor. Then she remembered she had left her father. She could see her house from the window. When the wave hit, it smashed the sliding doors. Then, to her horror, she saw her father swept outside. The water was by now the height of a one-story building. She saw him grab the ironwork on her home's second-story balcony and hold on. He was trying to pull himself up, but he has a bad leg, she said. As the water surged, her father was able to somehow hoist himself over the metal railing and onto the balcony. There he held on for dear life. "I didn't know he had it in him," she said. "He wanted so badly to live that he found the last burst of strength." After the earthquake, John Carucci, 33, who owns a local taxi company, drove to the homes of a half-dozen residents age 70 or older to ask if he could take them to higher ground. They refused, saying that there was no tsunami alert, so they would stay home. He survived the wave by going to the second floor of his company office, which withstood the tsunami. The next morning, when he finally ventured out again, the homes of all six of the older residents were washed away. "The elderly can't take care of themselves in a disaster like this," he said. "They didn't stand a chance." This story, "It's Strange That I'm Alive," was compiled from reports by Michael Sheridan of the London Sunday Times and Martin Fackler of the New York Times. Now let's move on to the section from the Week magazine entitled Talking Points. The first item today is entitled Wisconsin, Who Won and Who Lost. In Wisconsin's bitter battle over public labor unions, everyone lost something, said Natasha Vargas Cooper in the Atlantic.com. Governor Scott Walker and Republican legislators ended a three-week standoff with public workers last week by using a procedural trick to force through a bill that severely limits union pay and collective bargaining rights. The result, Walker and at least eight of his Republican colleagues in the Senate face recall efforts in the coming months by union supporters. Walker won the procedural round by tweaking his bill so that he could pass it without the Democratic legislators who fled the state, said E.J. Dion Jr. in the Washington Post. But in the process, he lost the public relations war. Unions had already acceded to wide-ranging concessions, including higher pension and health care contributions, making Walker look like an inflexible ideologue. Alienating union and blue-collar workers will hurt the GOP in the next national election. Quite the opposite, said the National Review Online in an editorial. It's the unions and progressives who came off like thugs by trying to stampede into the Capitol building, comparing Walker to Hitler, and shutting down the essential business of government. As governor, Walker has a duty to close $3.6 billion budget shortfall over the next 2 years and curb flagrant abuse of taxpayer money. His bill was hardly draconian. It simply requires union members to contribute modest amounts to their own health insurance and pensions. For all the cheap talk about civil rights, the left's rage really stems from the fact that Walker's bill also ended mandatory dues payments and gives workers an annual vote on whether they want to continue union representation. That will mean that union bosses can no longer count on their ability to funnel union dues to Democratic politicians. That's a big victory for conservatives, said Peter Beinart in the DailyBeast.com, but it might cost them the 2012 presidential election. For the first 2 years of Obama's presidency, Republicans pretty successfully portrayed him as a radical, frightening figure. But in the past 6 months, hard-right conservatives like Walker have dragged Republicans so far to the right that they're reframed Obama as a man of the center, making him look to independents like a bulwark against conservative radicalism. emboldened Tea Partiers are now seeking to take a meat cleaver to state and federal budgets and crush public unions. For the next 2 years, the more conservatives win, the more Republicans lose. Our next article here is entitled, NPR, Does It Deserve Taxpayer Subsidies? Ron Schiller picked a very bad time to embarrass his employer, said Jack Kelly in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Schiller, the head fundraiser for National Public Radio, was recently caught in a video sting operation expressing his scorn for Christians, Republicans, and the Tea Party, while swarmily pleading for a $5 million donation from a fake Muslim organization. In branding Tea Partiers as gun-toting racist, Schiller, who has since resigned, along with NPR's CEO, only illustrated what has been obvious all along, that NPR serves as a propaganda outlet for elitist liberals and is thus undeserving of taxpayer support. With Congress looking to cut unnecessary spending, it's obviously time to pull the plug on the $450 million that taxpayers pour into the Corporation for Public Broadcasting annually, which in turn provides about 2% of NPR's funding. NPR is obviously the gray poupon of federal subsidies, said Deborah Saunders in the San Francisco Chronicle. We're out of money and can't afford it. Of course we can, said Rodney Benson in the CSMonitor.com. In the U.S., we spend less than $1.50 a year per capita on subsidized public broadcasting, compared with upwards of $30 in other developed nations, and a recent study of 14 countries shows that public media created better-informed citizens who are integral to the vitality of our democracy. Besides its small public stations that would suffer the most without the federal grant, said Clarence Page in the Chicago Tribune, the lion's share of federal subsidies goes to these stations. It accounts for 10% to 40% of their budgets, and it's likely they would go dark if NPR were zeroed out. This would be a shame, since those mostly rural outposts are still carrying out public broadcasting's original 1967 mandate to bring more news, information, and cultural choices to all Americans. But in 2011, NPR has a substantial donor base and a loyal audience of 26 million listeners, said Victor Davis Hansen in the National Review Online. So let the federal training wheels come off. In the end, NPR will be far better off if it doesn't have to answer to Republicans or politicians of any party, said Matt Welch in CNN.com. It could ask liberal philanthropist George Soros for a few hundred million bucks or stage the mother of all pledge drives. It's simply not fair to force taxpayers to fund the listening habits of people who hate them. And finally, from Talking Points, the King hearings, what did they achieve? Smearing minorities as old as politicking, said the Seattle Times in an editorial. The latest fraud to inflame cultural bias for political gain is Republican Representative Peter King of Long Island, New York, who last week held a transparently bigoted congressional hearing into the threat of radicalization in the American Muslim community. Rather than calling expert witnesses and considering actual facts, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, King mounted an attack on U.S. Muslims with paranoid rhetoric, third-hand anecdotes, and made-up statistics, such as the ludicrous unsourced assertion that 80% of U.S. mosques are run by radicals. Unfortunately for King, Los Angeles County Sheriff Lee Baca testified that 7 of the past 10 known terrorist plots involving al-Qaeda were foiled by information provided by Muslim Americans. And the hearing's one indelible moment came from Representative Keith Ellison, one of two Muslims in Congress, who broke down in tears telling the story of a young American Muslim who died trying to rescue his fellow citizens from the Twin Towers on 9/11. That Muslim man, Ellison said, was an American who gave everything for his fellow Americans. Don't blame King because there's an association between terrorism and Islam, said Rich Lowry in National Review Online. Blame Army Major Nidal Hassan, who allegedly shouted, Allahu Akbar, while gunning down 13 people at Fort Hood, Texas, and all the other homegrown extremists who have perpetrated or attempted mayhem in the name of Allah. King called it, as witnesses, two men whose family members became radicalized in the U.S. When Abzariak Behi, one of the men, told Muslim leaders in Minneapolis that he was going to warn law enforcement about his radical nephew, they threatened me, intimidated me. Behi testified, "It's not bigotry to point out that Islam is infected with extremists who believe in uncompromising violence as a political tool," said David Harsanyi in the Denver Post. "That's just reality." No less liberal a figure than Attorney General Eric Holder has admitted that the special threat posed by radicalized Muslims within our own borders is one of the few things keeping him up at night. So why, other than political correctness, should those charged with protecting us be barred from discussing the topic? But why single out Islam for investigation, said Clarence Page in the Chicago Tribune. As King personally knows, other ethnic groups and religions have radical strains, too. During the 1980s, the very same Peter King was an outspoken supporter of the Irish Republican Army and even justified the IRA's terrorist bombing of British civilians. Muslims have no monopoly on mayhem. Indeed, the majority of ideologically motivated attacks on U.S. soil in recent decades have come from the white supremacist, pro-life Christian zealots, and anti-government militia types. The government has no business examining any peaceful religious group for the crimes of a few bad apples, said Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. If it did, King should conduct hearings into the Roman Catholic Church, complicit in the sexual abuse of an estimated 100,000 children since 1950. The truth, of course, is that Islamist extremists no more represent the Muslim community than a pedophile priest does all priests or all Catholics. As we get near to the end of the program for this week, a couple of brief mentions here. Japan's 9.0 magnitude earthquake released so much energy that it shifted the position of the Earth's axis by about 6.5 inches, according to estimates by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. The massive quake, caused by the sudden slipping of one giant tectonic plate under another, moved Japan 10 feet closer to North America. And the poll watch, 64% of Americans now say the war of Afghanistan has not been worth fighting, the highest percentage yet to say so. That's from the Washington Post and ABC News poll. And 43% of Americans side with NFL players in their ongoing dispute with owners over revenue sharing. 20% side with the owners themselves. And we have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast right after this broadcast. So long until next time, and be sure to remember that our new premiere time for The Week magazine is every Thursday at 3:00 in the afternoon, right here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Again, so long until next time.